And now we have a fireside chat that you really, really don't want to miss. Maybe you go to the loo, go to the loo. But this is not something that you are going to not remember. In 2001, this guy spent months convincing two reluctant shareholders that they should sell their stake in a very small Chinese company. It was a company called QQ. He got the deal done for his employers. Nice pass. $33 million it cost for around half of what was then a tiny little company called Tencent. That stake has been described by the venture capital icon Mike Moritz of Sequoia Capital in California as the greatest investment in history. That's a big, big statement. But Hans Havankos wasn't around to see this payoff. His contract wasn't renewed the following year. Now, maybe it was a question of timing. Maybe it was a question of bad luck. But there are many questions that we need to be asking of him. How he found Tencent, which, by the way, is at that stake of $33 million at one point was worth $100 billion. It's completely transformed NASPERS or process, and it has also added huge value to almost all of your portfolios because it's in pretty much every pension fund in South Africa. So when you look at what you're going to be getting out in your retirement, just know that Hans had a role in it. He had a part in it. He's very low profile. He does not do this. I convinced him when we visited my friend Mike Wiley in St. Francis and had a conversation there and met Hans and Karen. And it's really a privilege to have Hans Havankos here to tell us the story of Tencent, the story of his business career, and indeed, a story of hope. Hans.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, the leader in offshore investing, connecting South Africa to opportunities worldwide. Invest better with Brenthurst.
Finding Tencent at a time when nobody else wanted it has got a long story to it as well. I have a good friend who worked at MultiChoice, and it's almost forgotten now that there's a room at MultiChoice called the Hans Havankos Room. How did that come about, and how did you actually get into MultiChoice in the first part before we go to Asia?
Yeah, so this is like 25, 30 years ago. I was working for one of Saul Kirzner's companies, another entrepreneur, and was headhunted into Mnet, which had then in 1993 had just broken even with about 500,000 subscribers. And at that time, Chris Becker and his number two, Kubis, had bought a business in Holland called Filmnet. And he based himself in Amsterdam. And he wanted somebody to come in and distribute the Mnet analog signal across Africa. So I then started MultiChoice. We called it MultiChoice, a distribution arm of Mnet. Mnet those days had content. It had sports, movies, and kiddies programs. And I did a lot of rebroadcast deals in analog format across different African countries. For example, Nigeria, Ghana, Zambia, Kenya, and even Egypt. And the deal was always that the local broadcaster would retain the license and we would provide the technical expertise and take half the share for our business. But that was the rebroadcast analog model. Kurs had a tech company in Naspers called Irdeto, and they developed a digital encryption technology, which allowed us to encrypt digital signals. And very soon, we realized that DirecTV had launched its DirecTV service in the U.S., and DirecTV is owned by Hughes Corporation, and we should follow suit. Because we had a tech, it took me about 2 years with the team at MultiChoice to launch DSTV, Digital Satellite Television. And in South Africa, we used a small dish, KU band, 90 centimeter dish, whereas in Africa, we used a bigger C band dish, 1.5 centimeter dish. And that was a much better way then of distributing the content across Africa. And one of the key things we had to do, Alec, was to form the DSTV bouquet. What channels are we going to offer? So we had the Mnet channel itself. They devolved into sports, movies, and kiddies. And I did a lot of deals then with all the international channels to bring them on board the DSTV platform. CNN, BBC, you know all the channels you see today. But the one thing we did also do was to think about public broadcasters. At the same time, SABC were going to launch its competitor called AstroSat in analog format, and I killed that. But I took their channels onto my DSTV bouquet. But we also thought about international public broadcasters. And this is where China comes in. Mandela was released in 94, is it?
91.
91. So we used that goodwill to think about, why don't we approach the Chinese? Because they had an international channel called CCTV4 as part of their CCTV channels. They had 10 of them. So Chris and I traveled to Beijing, 1994, somewhere around there. It was difficult. I mean, I didn't enjoy going to Beijing. It was still coming out of its difficult time. I mean, you think back in China those days, they'd come out of a land of scarcity. They had all these terrible social programs like the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution. And in fact, people that went through that were actually unemployable. They were scarred so much by those social programs. So it was a very difficult environment, hardly any cars on the streets in Beijing, loads and loads and tons of bicycles. And I was actually scared to stay in the hotel. I thought I was being watched. Anyway, so Chris and I went and we met with the ministry and the CCTV people. And over time, we developed what we call Guangxi, which is a relationship of trust and work with these people. And I used Mandela's sort of goodwill as well in the process. He came to China for a state visit. I hosted him in our Chinese offices in Beijing. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience for the Chinese people and myself to talk to him. In turn, the Chinese president came to South Africa, Jiang Zemin, in 1995 or somewhere around there. And the only company he visited was Mnet in Randburg, nobody else. So we developed a very good relationship with the Chinese government. Now, dealing with the Chinese government is very different to dealing with the entrepreneurial side of China, which I'll get to later. But that was the start of an approach to get into China, to develop some kind of goodwill. And we took their CCTV channel and put it onto our DSTV platform. That was the start of an initiative and thinking about what else can we do with China.
So it all went back to turning or creating what is now MultiChoice, and probably everybody in this room has had
some experience, hopefully.
Because of the live sport. And then you had this relationship with China. Why leave a very successful model? Because MultiChoice was printing cash at one point in time. It's keeping the whole of Naspers alive.
Yeah, so we used the MultiChoice cash generation to develop our business. Kurs was in the meantime, and that's where I met Rob first, because Rush once funded some of the, we called it net holders those days, in Europe, our ventures in Europe. We were expanding in Italy. Rob was involved with Telepew in Italy. We did a deal with Silvano Berlusconi, who bought a 5% share in Mediaset. We established ourselves in Central Europe. Kurs was busy in Scandinavia. So we really grew fast, and Johan was funding this.
Johan Rupert.
But then it became a big black hole. And long story short, we sold our European interests to Canal Plus, who, as you know, recently bought MultiChoice. Wheel turned. And Kus and the team came back to South Africa. That's when he took over Naspers. He got a 3% share from Ton Fossler, very generous. And he said to me, Hans, you've done a lot of deals and worked in China. Why don't you take your family and move to Hong Kong? That was in just after the handover in 1997. I took my family, four boys out of school, and based myself in Hong Kong. And the idea was to establish a Naspers footprint in Asia, particularly focused on television, mainly. But then at the same time, the internet was bubbling. And we launched MWeb in South Africa to learn from what does this thing look like. And we kind of followed the US model where Yahoo had launched as a content provider. You guys may still remember the name Yahoo. And AOL was the ISP providing access. And as you know, AOL eventually bought Time Warner. Long story. But that is the model we were following. Do a content deal like a Yahoo and provide connectivity to the internet, like the AOL model. And we sort of followed that thinking and strategy in developing our interests in Asia. Me being based in Hong Kong.
And presumably it was much more livable than Beijing.
Very much so. And then the Chinese Hong Kong people are very different to the Beijing people who speak Mandarin. The same character set, but the Hong Kong Chinese speak Cantonese, and it's an impossible language to learn. Mandarin, difficult, but slightly easier. But yeah, so the Hong Kong people are very different, but much more livable for me and my family.
What was your mandate when you were sent to Hong Kong?
I had less operational involvement, but more in call it a VC investor type model, where I would look to invest in opportunities across Asia. And we focused principally on China, Southeast Asia being Indonesia and Thailand. So in Thailand, I did a deal with, I merged two entities to form a pay TV company called UBC. It was a merger between Thaksin Shinawat, who became the prime minister of Thailand, and the biggest conglomerate in Thailand, the CP Group. I put the two together because they were competing. And in pay television, if two guys are competing, you both lose because you're fighting for the same content, you outbid yourself, and you lose money. No good. So it has to be a single entity. So I did that and then started. In China, we could never really get to do anything on television because they wanted to control the media, as you can imagine. But I did do a technology deal where I provided them encryption technology, which we had, for them to distribute the international channels to the compounds in China, as well as to the hotels.
Who's the compounds?
That's where the international people lived. And so I managed to do that. But, you know, in dealing with the government, I mean, what was it? Bernard said this morning about legacy leaves the room. In China, when China enters the room, the prophets leave the room. I mean, they just use that leverage unbelievably strongly. So it's very difficult to do a deal. And if anything, you'll just get the crumbs of a deal. That happened to many of the motor manufacturers that established foothold in China at the same time as I was busy doing my stuff. So I did that with the state broadcaster, but we couldn't get any further on television. But then with the internet bubbling, it created a huge growth in entrepreneurship in Southeast Asia as well as China. So in the late 90s, we were looking for opportunities. Now, we came at our investors, our thinking was always with a control mentality. We wanted to control things. And that's why Kus and Naspers still today have those N shares, because we were always worried that Rupert Murdoch would come and attack us and buy out MultiChoice. Hence, Kus established this very strong control structure. And we had that mindset in thinking about opportunities in Asia. But that meant that it precluded me from doing deals because there's no way I could get control from some of these young entrepreneurs starting the internet companies. For example, I met with Alibaba, Jack Ma. You've heard of Jack Ma. I couldn't do a deal with him. I could have bought a 7% share. I had to turn it down. Eventually, Goldman Sachs bought it. There's another company, NetEase, the gaming company. He offered me a 10% share for X amount, and I couldn't take it. We turned it down. So with that control philosophy, we did our own thing in China. Asia's a bit different. So I did a lot of – one other joint venture I did in Beijing was with a data hosting business, which today you'll call a data center. And my partner there was IDG Ventures, and I'll come back to that. But other than that, we set up our own companies, content and connectivity. So we spent quite a bit of money, obviously, in developing these initiatives, both in China as well as Thailand, as well as Indonesia. And you must say we were just throwing spaghetti at the wall. Not quite true, but we were trying to find a foothold using the model of content and connectivity in the early days of internet and its growth.
And why China? Why did you think that you could go into a market where presumably you weren't fluent in Cantonese at this point?
Nothing.
Where you could have a successful business that you controlled?
Yeah, in hindsight, it's impossible. So we tried to put a sports filter together in Shanghai. We tried this connectivity business in Beijing, and it failed. So we were trying lots of different little things, to be honest, and we weren't really making any progress until one day my partner in this data business, IDG Ventures, which is an American company. I'm sitting here in Hong Kong. I get a phone call, and they say to me, look, we are shareholders in this young company called Tencent, and we are a 25% shareholder. And we've been there for 2 years, but the four Chinese founders don't like us because we haven't added any value and we are just drip feeding them money. So we want to sell our shares. So IDG said to me, okay, we'll sell our shares to you, our 25%, but you need to convince the Chinese founders. Only one of them could speak English, the others couldn't, and I used through interpreters with them. If I could convince them that we as Naspers would become a good partner, a good shareholder, that they would accept that. And if I'd convinced them, I must then convince the other 25% shareholder, the VC company based in Hong Kong called PCCW, convince them to sell their 25% share. And if I managed to do that, we would end up with a 50% share plus one share in Tencent.
Control.
Control. But yes, you have control in theory in China, but in practice, forget it. You'll never be able to exercise control in China. No way. Anyway, so that was the opportunity. Now, it didn't fit our strategy because Tencent was a communication platform. This Penguin QQ would be used to communicate. And on the laptop, these Chinese would talk to each other in real time using the service, but only on the laptop. And they had, by that time, about 20 million or so users. And at that time, because broadband wasn't really quite established yet, nor was a mobile phone, most of the activity took place in internet cafes in China. So I used to walk around all these internet cafes. They see these buggers using QQ, beep, 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 and they would be communicating. It's just magical.
So it's like WhatsApping each other.
Yes.
You can only do it in an internet cafe.
Yes.
On a laptop. So it's like a small market.
Small market at that stage. Okay. Limited. No revenue. So obviously I took this opportunity to the Naspers executive and I said, look, this is what we could potentially do. Shall I take it further? Answer was yes. So I then drove to Shenzhen. Now, Shenzhen was one of those economic centers that was established by the government quite a few years before, in China's reform, they developed agriculture, they developed these special economic zones, they created a competitive environment, and they were about to join the WTO in 2001. So Tencent had based themselves in one of these economic zones called Shenzhen, which is in southeast China. It was quite easy to access it from Hong Kong. I would drive along for about half an hour, get to the border. I'd have to board a train for about half a kilometer to get across the border and always packed like sardines in this flipping train. Get out across the border and get to about 100 and something passport stations, take my visa, get through and walk to the Tencent premises where I met Pony Ma, who was the head. He could speak a bit of English. And his three other partners, Daniel, Charles, and I forget the other guy. Anyway, so it took about three or four.
How old was Pony Ma? Pony Ma, by the way, if you don't know, is one of the richest people in the world today, and one of the great entrepreneurs of the world. Wherever you go, you mention Pony Ma, it's well known. How old was he at this stage?
His early 30s. Very entrepreneurial, super guy, and... yes, I got on very well with him and the team and convinced them that we, as multi-choice, I call it NASPAS, broadly speaking, we had a game plan for how we could assist them and grow their business, which they bought into. So IDG heard about that. They were happy then to sell their share. The founders of Tencent, they took comfort from the fact that I could help them and they were willing to accept us as partners. But I then had the challenge to try and convince the Hong Kong guys, PCCW, to sell their shares to me. Now, PCCW was owned by a guy called Richard Lee, and he was a son of Lee Kai-shing, the wealthiest Hong Kong fellow, and extremely arrogant, very difficult to deal with. And equally so was his M&A guy, Mika Chung. I remember him clearly. It was a very tough negotiation. Because I would meet with the PCCW team and we would talk through, you know, why do I want to buy this company which they can't see any opportunity for? I said, look, you know, if I had a game plan, I wouldn't tell you anyway. But we see something there we'd like to buy. But it took me about 3 months of discussions and toing and froing to try and get this 25% share. Clearly, I'd briefed, of course, an executive in the meantime. But one fine day, I get the phone call from Mika Chung, the M&A guy. And he said to me, Hans, and he used different words, but anyway. He said, Hans, we'll sell our shares to you. The valuation of the company will be $66 million. I'm giving you no time to do any due diligence. Take it or leave it. In other words, I had to pay as NASPAS $33 million for a 50% share, buying out PCCW share as well as the IDG Ventures share. Put the phone down, I phoned Chris. This is the story. So we've done our homework, obviously. We've done some prep. The bottom line is after a long discussion with the NASPAS executive, most of them weren't in favor of the deal. Reason being that all the other opportunities that I'd invested in China and Asia, weren't any realizing any benefit. We'd spent about $60, $70 million. We had just gone through the dot-com crash. We had tried to go on to, we were listed on NASDAQ as MIH. We were looking to raise money and it didn't work out too well. So money was short. So this opportunity came actually at a very wrong time. But at the end of the day, long story short, Kurs backed the deal. Steve Pasak, who was our finance guy, was told to go to an APSA bank to borrow the $33 million from Donnie Cornier. And Kurs backed it. Steve got the money. We did the deal. And that's
if Donnie Cornier had said, he was my boss, by the way. I worked for Donnie for 2.5 years. If he'd said no, the deal wouldn't have happened. Or were there other bankers?
I'm not sure. I don't know what course it up his sleeve. I don't know.
But he did say yes.
Chris, well, Idani said yes, obviously. EPSA were our bankers from day one, actually, MNet day. So he knew the history. He knew Chris. He backed Chris as well. And Chris backed the deal. He said, let's go for it. Now, I've met Danny since many times, and we've gone through the story. He said, you know, he just believed in Chris and what he was all about, and he thought this would be a good deal. The other thing was one of our board members was also a board member of AOL in the US. And AOL had a similar kind of company called ICQ, also a communication platform. And his name was Bill Radushel. And Bill also gave confidence to Chris, say, listen, this could be something. But the problem is this company had no revenue. Yeah, same old problem. Good opportunity, 20 million users, but no revenue. And there were other instances of that as well. So it was a big risk. It was a big punt.
What made you so confident?
I liked the management team. I mean, you backed the jockey, and those jockeys, those guys, were really, really impressive.
In what way?
They're pretty much straightforward, honest, and we got lucky there because you got some bad apples out there as well. And I just had a good rapport with Pony Ma. I just really got on very well with him, and I felt comfortable in being able to deal with him, and he felt comfortable with me. The chemistry works, whereas his previous experience with IDG and PCCW was terrible. It was a terrible experience for him. He just felt more comfortable in working with me. So it's hard to explain. You know, it's just a personality thing.
Why did he not go to a bank and raise the money himself to buy them out?
I'm not sure, Eric.
Did he not have the resource to be able to?
He wouldn't have had. He was a VC. He was reliant on VC money from day one. I'm not sure whether he thought of other options in particular to go to a banker for them to buy out these two shareholders. I think he wanted more than money. He actually wanted a partnership, somebody that could help him monetize at that day his 20 million user base. And that was more important for him than just purely, you know, just getting money dropped down. The bank would have given him money possibly, but nothing else. And he needed something else.
Was your South African nationality an advantage in this discussion?
Well, as I said, we'd established a Guangxi with the government in Beijing, which is very different in dealing with those guys than working with these young budding entrepreneurs. Very different. It's hard to say. I never brought them out to South Africa before the deal. I did bring out the Chinese government people to South Africa. They loved the country. I definitely used that aspect in saying we have established a rapport with CCTV4 in Beijing, and politically we were well aligned. I don't think it may have affected him that much that we are South African. He just felt comfortable that, you know, we could work with him and help him monetize his user base.
So this is a bet of $33 million. In the context of what you'd invested, how big was it?
It was the biggest investment that we'd made on one single opportunity. But in total, throughout all the opportunities, I'd spent about $80 million between China, Thailand, and Indonesia.
So this was really
substantial.
It was shooting your ammo. It was your It was your big bet.
And we had no money.
And you had no. So take us forward now. Now you're sitting in Hong Kong. Presumably you've made the investment. You go up to Shenzhen regularly, I guess.
Yes. Now, so what I first, I had a 1 year opportunity to work with these guys before my contract wasn't renewed. And in that 1 year, I sort of helped semi-corporatize Tencent. But the biggest thing we tried to work on was how do we monetize the opportunity? What do we do? And we found a breakthrough. One of the founders had a relationship with this new company called China Mobile. And China Mobile was just establishing itself. And they were just about to launch 3G in China. And we said, okay, you know, we should try and do a deal with China Mobile because we offer data traffic, because we had a lot of data traffic. And we would like to change our business from a PC platform only to a mobile platform. So let's look at doing a deal with China Mobile. And we did a deal. The deal was that, and China Mobile was now just getting going and established, that the China Mobile subscribers would pay $1 a month subscription to access Tencent. They would collect the money. They would keep 15% and pay over 85% of the dollar to Tencent. So that benefited China Mobile in the sense that there was a growing data traffic on their platform, which they liked. It's a revenue source for them. And for Tencent, obviously our own Tencent revenue source. And that was the start of a revenue source. Now, clearly, over the years, China Mobile became a massive player. Broadband grew in China. There was no more need to go to the internet cafes and try to do communication. There was no need to worry about only on laptop. It was all on mobile. And that's how the business really grew rapidly.
It's a wonderful, wonderful business story, but your own story. Why was your contract not renewed? You'd done this big deal, which turned out to be the best investment in history.
Of course, I don't know. I really don't know.
You still to this day don't know why it was not renewed?
No. So, I mean, I listened to, where's Bernard, is he around here? He said this morning about Mandela and forgiveness and so on. There's a scar that my contract wasn't renewed. I came back to South Africa. But I didn't allow that scar to fester and control my life thereafter. I put it behind me. I came back to South Africa. I took on the job of CEO of Virgin Active. I worked for Richard Branson for a year. Not a great experience. I then helped MTN look for a second GSM license in Saudi. I got to know the MTN guys. I then worked for a Saudi wealth family many years. I worked for a German wealth family. And then I said, no more of travel. And I based myself in South Africa. And I took on a board membership of Truworths, which is where I am today. And I got a couple of tech investments, and that's it. But with Chris, Curvis number two has come back to me, and we had a long chat. And I think they recognized what called a mistake was made. But Chris, nothing. He did invite me to a couple of functions, which I attended. Really sort of, yeah, flimsy discussions, but nothing of substance. And that's it.
Was the non-renewal of your contract part of a countrywide, or rather corporate-wide cutting back?
No, because I had a 5-year contract to move from South Africa to Hong Kong. When I left, somebody else came in and took my position, but then based himself in Thailand. Why there, I don't know. And then they closed the Hong Kong office after a couple of years. So Tencent was listed about a year after I left. Just listed at $760 million, so 10 times the value, more than 10 times the value, 2 years after we bought it. And then they moved the office back to South Africa. They've now reestablished an office in Hong Kong. But Tencent grew because the people there were just unbelievably good and creative in the way they were able to add value to the business over the many, many years. And I've kept in touch with the team, sort of. And when they launched WeChat, about 6 years after we bought it, I mean, that just exploded and grew massively. So they were incredibly good at incrementally adding value to the business. And that's due to Pony Ma and the founders. And I say again, you know, there's no way in our wildest dreams could we have thought that this little budding company would be so valuable today. The only other similar thing would be Alibaba. So I said before we missed that one, but the Japanese guy, which is known Masayoshi Son from SoftBank, he ended up buying a 35% share in Alibaba and he made his fortune there. He's used all that money to, you know, you've heard of him, and he's all over the place. So that is the only other big success story as a foreigner in the China market. Because China is difficult. You know, and if we had backed Jack Ma, when he raised his head up, not cleverly. And as I say, in China, the tall winds catch the brunt of the high winds. You try and get too famous, you'll get brought down. So he was brought down in a very big way many years ago, as you know. So it's a very difficult market. And
everyone's looking for the next 10 cent. Everyone likes a 10 bagger is miraculous. This is a 100 times plus bagger. Have you done that as well? Have you said to yourself, I can find another one of those? I mean, or was this just one-off opportunity?
I would say it's a one-off. And now, if you take Naspers today, I mean, they're trying to do a lot of different things, food delivery and all kinds of platforms and so on. And they're always trying to compare what Naspers is doing today with the Tencent investment, which is actually unfair, to be honest. Because Tencent is really a once-off. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. So it's difficult to compare Naspers' other investments in the same way. There was one other opportunity. A South African liquor company had dealings with China. They were in the cider business. And they were sourcing the apple extract from China to make the cider in South Africa. And they then called me, the South African company called me and said, look, we want you to help us establish a manufacturing foothold in China to distribute our cider product in China. So I helped them. I set up the joint venture that you have to work through a WFOE structure, a wholly foreign entity. Set the whole thing up, but the key was distribution. Now, there are about six and a half or so million distribution outlets in China. And to try and launch a new brand, you need distribution. South African Breweries did a deal with Snow Breweries in China, similar time as I was busy out there. So I got to know the holding company, China Resources. So I approached them and I said, listen, can you're the big brewing company. They had access to 3 million distribution outlets in China. And if we could do a JV with you, you can take our product, which we'll manufacture in China, the cider product, and distribute it into your distribution outlets. I'd signed an MOU with them. I'd brought the whole team out to South Africa to meet the South African team. And I wondered over the Christmas period why this thing wasn't really happening. What's going on? I hadn't heard from these guys. And it so happened that Heineken, who are a premium beer supplier, were also talking to these people. And Heineken had their own cider brand called Strongbow. And the bottom line was Heineken did a corporate deal where they bought a 35% share in Snow Breweries in China, and use that platform to distribute the Strongbow cider business in China, which prohibited us from doing a deal. But I came so close. Because if we had done that deal, it would have been a massive breakthrough for the South African company, Distell. As it happens, Heineken now bought Distell.
A couple of questions before we go off to dinner. Rory Steyn wants to know, he says, Hans, well done. You hear horror stories about how much late night drinking is involved in concluding deals in China. Gumbai, care to comment?
No, Rory, you're right. In dealing with the government officials, that is most definitely part of the guangxi and the relationship building. You do attend dinners, a lot of gambais. It gets quite hectic. The food you have to try and eat is not so pleasant. You have to be polite. You've got to go hide the stuff away under your serviette or to not offend them. The deep-fried scorpion, you're going to tuck it away. So it's difficult, but there's a lot of that. in dealing with the government officials, but far less so with the entrepreneurs like Pony Ma. So it's a very different environment in dealing with these entrepreneurs versus the government officials. Very different. Yeah, so drinking is part of the game.
Rob Herzog's got a number of comments, and you can read it on the BNC 9 chat. But he says, this part, I feel both great sadness and anger at hearing Hans tell this, but I also look at Hans and I'm in awe at how he handled this. It would have broken most other people. Huge respect. What are you working on and what excites you in business now?
Well, when I heard Stafford talk, Rob, this afternoon, I want to work on that. The data center, that opportunity, that sounds absolutely fascinating. So that's one thing. I've totally embraced AI. I've learned a lot about it. I've read a lot about it. We've taken AI. I'm on the board of Truworths, and the CEO, Michael Mark, has been there for a long time. Huge amount of energy, and he's fully embraced AI in the business. So it's very exciting to be part of that program. I have some other small tech investments, some good, some not so good. But this thing that Stafford talked about, Rob, and what you're thinking of doing, I'll give you a call.
Just to close off with, Africa today, some people say, is at the same stage that China was maybe at the time that you were doing transaction, or you did the transaction with Tencent. And you know Africa. You've traveled it well through your multi-choice days. Is there anything on the continent that, or anything that would pull you into having another look at the potential that, if it is to be unlocked, would presumably deliver huge returns?
In Africa. Now, if I think about China, it is absolutely a unique model that existed there. So the state control centralized the politics, but the local government did all the execution on a micro level. I was listening to Jordan talk about devolution. And it's so true. That model worked in China. State control at the center politically, developing the five-year plans, whereas the local government officials execute. And they were very, very competitive in the way they did that. And that model clearly became very successful. Over a 30-year period, about 20 million private companies were listed, were started up in China. 20 million. 60%, if I remember the number, 60% of the GDP output came from private enterprise over the 30-year period. 70% of the wealth was created by these private companies. So it was an amazing economic transformation, which I was part of. It was very exciting. Now, can I see that in Africa, Alec? I did a lot of deals. It's difficult. It's very difficult. I couldn't see it happening now.
The message I take out of that is if we had different parts of our country competing against each other, in other words, local authorities, for businesses.
Correct.
It's a bit like in the United States. I remember watching two governors going at each other, one from Kansas, one from Louisiana, I think it was, going at each other and saying, "What, we have got better incentives to get the businesses here." And the other one said, "But our schools are better, and that's why the people want to come here," and so on. What you've just described in China, if that part of the model can be translated into South Africa.
Absolutely. It worked beautifully in China and became very, very competitive amongst the local councillors to get your business. And they would do everything to encourage you to develop a factory or something in their area because they look good. And they would see it as a stepping stone up the corporate ladder in the Communist Party. It was a huge win for them if they could attract a foreign investment, particularly the SIDA project. I mean, I set the thing up in Xi'an province, way out west. They were so excited. The councillors were falling over themselves to try to help me. Now, you know, if you could create that environment in South Africa, that kind of model, it would be unbelievable.
Well, Hans, maybe a light will go on. Thank you again for sharing your story here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst. Start your day a step ahead. BizNews Insider. It delivers the business stories that matter every morning straight to your inbox. Sharp, fast, and free. Subscribe now.